So normally here at the Reason Editors Roundtable podcast, we record on Monday morning and release it in the afternoon. It's a nice little schedule, keeps us all regular. It's very important when you get to a certain age. And we had decided that, well, since there's a big election on Tuesday, that we would reconvene on Thursday morning when we are talking right now with my colleagues, Catherine Mangu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Peter Suderman, and that we would talk about the post-election news and kind of digest it and figure out what it means to all of us. And so we made this regularly scheduled or irregularly scheduled podcast. And my God, how much news has dropped between election night and now? I think by the time we're finished actually having our hour-long or hour-short conversation here, we might be in another land war in Southeast Asia, and there will be a new war cabinet. Things are just going crazy all over. Jeff Sessions has been fired, resigned. There's a horrifying shooting out in California, in Ventura. Things are just flying off the handles. Some rando named Whitaker is now apparently the acting attorney general of the United States. Things are going off the rails, but we are going to focus here on something that does have some meaning and impact in our lives over the next 2 years, which is the election results that happened on Tuesday. And I think as libertarian weirdos, and Nick, that's an affectionate term. Okay,
gotcha.
I know we've had that conversation before with Bill Weld. We have some kind of unique perspective on things. So I wanted to go over that with you, the listener, and you, my colleagues there. And I want to start with Peter Suderman on this, because you have a particularly, I think, given the mania in this country at the moment, or what feels like the mania, Catherine probably doesn't think it's as much mania as we all believe, but you have this counterintuitive idea, Peter, that this election was kind of normal, or at least was handled on normal things. What are you talking about?
So let's table everything that has happened since the election for a moment. But the election
including
itself,
Ruth Bader Ginsburg's ribs. Let's not leave that out. She broke a bunch of ribs.
Let's not actually table them. Let's leave them in her and hope that they heal.
Don't put them on the table.
Quickly.
Sorry. Carry on.
So look at this. The run-up to this election was crazy. It was Betomania, and maybe there's aliens, and a bizarre 2 week, 4 week. It seemed like we were like lost in the Kavanaugh caverns forever here on this podcast. Even there was all of this stuff about the Mueller probe and Russian interference and just sort of, you know, and like, and then also Trump's Twitter feed and the migrant caravan, which was, you know, a million miles away, probably actually like further than the moon is from the planet, from the United States. But it was the main subject of Trump's Twitter feed and Fox News for a while. And I really felt kind of hysterical for a lot of ways. But if you look at the actual races and the issues they were fought on, they were really pretty normal in many ways. The biggest domestic policy issue, especially for Democrats, but overall, turned out to be healthcare. And so people were arguing about whether or not Obamacare was good, whether it was good in its current form, and about whether or not to expand Medicaid. There were three Medicaid ballot initiatives. So following the 2012 Supreme Court decision about the individual mandate that upheld the mandate, Obamacare's Medicaid expansion was made optional for states, and three states voted on ballot initiatives to expand. There were a couple of governors who were elected who had said that they want to expand. And then a bunch of the races were fought on pre-existing conditions, which have turned out to sort of be the most popular part of Obamacare, at least if you poll them without asking for the costs. Michael Cannon and the Cato Institute, Emily Eakins, who used to work for Reason, have polled, and they find that the polls look a little different if you talk about the way those pre-existing conditions rules raise the costs on people. But it was really like a fairly basic election that was fought on the economy, on education, on healthcare, on jobs, amongst, you know, people who were, these were kind of basic kitchen table issues. And then the election went basically the way we expected it to go, with a couple of pickups for Republicans in the Senate and a flip to the Democrats in the House. And so, you know, it turned out to be much less of a kind of a Trump is nuts election, and much more of a what what policies do people care about?
So what does it mean then? You know, basically, as of this moment, it's like 29 or 30 seats flipped in the House to the Democrats from the Republicans, which puts it in line with the historic average, basically, of midterm elections, first time out. And when you compare it to, you know, what Barack Obama, the shellacking he took, as he put it, in 2010, where I think they lost like 60 seats, the Democrats, and lost control of the House. Bill Clinton in 2004 also lost a shit ton.
It wasn't the big blue wave that a lot of the resist folks were looking for. Krasher of National Journal said, you know, this wasn't about resistance, it was about balance. And I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, because then what is off kilter in our in our politics right now? Because even as you were talking, Peter, you know, and I would argue it wasn't even about healthcare per se as much as it was about pre-existing conditions, that, or at least that's what the Democrats were running on, that to vote for.
So there was also Medicaid. I will really defend. It wasn't just pre-existing conditions. Medicaid was on the ballot in a bunch of different ways.
Yeah,
not every single race, but it did tend to win.
But I mean, the messaging was a vote for a Republican was a vote to kill people who have pre-existing conditions because they wouldn't be able to get health care. The economy ended up, you know, in third or fourth place, which is doing pretty well because on the Trump side, they were pushing the migrant caravan, especially, and also like a referendum on Trump. And these things kind of balance themselves out because like what we had is a completely average, kind of result for a president in power, et cetera. So then what is it that is like insane about our politics? Because even when you look at the past couple of years, you know, there was the Republican tax bill, which actually is very substantial and wouldn't have happened if Trump wasn't president, I think. But you get stuff like farm bills, you get increases in military spending. There is this bizarre thing where like the reality of the functioning of government is going on as if, you know, nothing has changed. And then we have this superstructure. I mean, this cartoon cloud of, you know, people yelling and screaming and resisting and Trump, you know, tweeting. It's, to me, this is like what I want after this election is like for us to actually stop paying attention to the circus because it's not actually substantive and it's not really changing how policy is being made. And I don't know how you guys feel, but like, and if the past 48 hours, which is like a supercharged version of the past 2 years, if we're going to be talking about, you know, freaking Jim Acosta's, whether or not he karate chopped a White House intern for a microphone, I mean, it's like the Zapruder film, there's already doctored versions and frame by frame, you know, like, I just count me out. It's too much.
I take your point, Nick. I might dispute a little bit of it. I think there are some actual policy differences between sort of the parties and the characters and some things that are new, particularly in regards to immigration and enforcement and taking into refugees. But one way of thinking about the point that you just made is think of all of the kind of perceived bitter division having to do with, on one hand, Colin Kaepernick, and then on the other hand, Donald Trump, right? You know, it's an anthem, all this kind of crap that we've talked about over the years and everyone's been talking about over the years. It would make you think that there is a bitter division in this country over criminal justice reform. And yet, even in Florida, the most bitterly divided and every race is in a runoff state in the union, you had, even as that was going on, they passed a very comprehensive and long overdue substantial re-enfranchisement bill. So people who have already served out their felony sentences now can vote in their next election. Finally, it's one of the first things I ever wrote a piece about for a reason. So criminal justice reform is actually a pretty bipartisan thing. It's actually happening on the grassroots. I think it's much more likely to happen now that Jeff Sessions has been fired and President Trump has indicated some willingness to do it. But if you go by just the kind of meta argument out there, you would miss that story. And I think there's a lot of that that does map onto politics. Before Catherine instructs us how to pronounce the word Rorschach, because I can't do it, and all this, I have a follow up for Suderman, which is or an invitation to look at a possible analogy. So 2010, Republicans retake the House in Obama's first midterm. Their big issue was to hold the line or to resist or be mad at Obamacare then. And so you could draw somewhat of a parallel. I think it was stronger as a single issue or one of two issues than the Medicare stuff is for this time. But it's part of
Medicaid, pre-existing conditions. Medicaid.
Yes, that, got it.
Medicare is different.
Got it. Don't start with your Terminator 2 analogy here. We're going to save that for the video release. So Republicans,
like a robot crushing a human skull forever.
Thank you.
With a very high deductible copay, though.
The robot or the human?
It doesn't matter. We're all androids
robot,
anyway, right?
Humans.
Didn't we go cyborg in like the second Clinton year term or something?
So my question to you, Peter, is that when Republicans retook the House, they had a long time to work out the policy implications of their anti-Obamacare victory and translate it into policy that they would unveil once they finally controlled all the levers of power, and they didn't do that. So is there an analogy to be made about what House Democrats are going to do? Can we anticipate 46 different types of bills for Medicare for all, but then in 2024, when it's President Beto and a fully Democratic majority, are they going to have nothing? What do you anticipate this being translated into House legislative sausage making, or do you anticipate just purely symbolic politicking about it?
I think this analogy is largely right, and I've written this in the past. When Republicans won in 2010, as you said, it was basically on the strength of Obamacare is bad. That was their argument. That's how they retook the House. And there's actually good political science research showing that if Democrats had not passed Obamacare in 2010, they almost certainly would have held control of the House, and they didn't. And then Republicans, you know, their rallying cry, their biggest single domestic policy priority for 8 years was repeal and replace Obamacare. They never came up with a viable replacement plan that they could all agree on. They didn't have legislation ready to go when they retook when the President Trump won the election in 2016 and they had control of the House and the Senate. And I think that we are likely to see a similar situation with Democrats. Now, Democrats are a little more policy-minded. They have people who are working on this sort of thing. And so I suspect that their policy plans will be somewhat more developed. However, I think it is quite likely that they won't have a unified sort of thing that they want to do that they're going to call Medicare for All. They're going to have a bunch of plans that do, some of which are like crazy full-on single-payer plans that, you know, all but outlaw in private insurance and that cost really insane amounts of money, even under very optimistic circumstances. And some of them are just going to be things that some of them are going to be kind of opt-in programs. You know, we've already seen some proposals like that from the Center for American Progress. And we may even see things as sort of a relatively smaller scale, though I would still say they represent pretty large expansions of government intervention in healthcare. Things as small as just doing a public option, which would be having the government run an insurance plan inside
so
Obamacare.
So none of that is going to – I predict that none of that is going to even come to serious votes in the House, much less it won't become law or won't make it to Trump's desk because the Senate is more firmly in Republican hands.
I'm not talking about Trump.
No.
What I'm talking about is that Republicans did all these votes while they had the House and not the
right.
But what I'm
saying is the Democratic
– they didn't actually have a plan ready and in place when they retook all the House, the Senate.
You're acting as if the Democrats between now and 2020, and they as much as you know, the Republicans or as much as Trump want to make everything about Trump, they're going to be spending all of their time huffing and puffing and investigating and, you know, sicking bulldogs on Donald Trump and Barron Trump, Donald Trump Jr. and Barron Trump and Erich and all of those people.
I think we should get Catherine in here.
And
but,
they don't even have a
but
speaker.
I will say that if you look at the major presidential, likely not the likely presidential candidates, from the Democratic Party right now, Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Elizabeth Warren, they are spending their sort of run-up time, their lead-in time, rolling out major policy plans.
No, they—
because Democrats just care about
major policy objectives. None of them— I mean, you know, what has Cory Booker done in the Senate? Virtually nothing. Kamala Harris, nothing. Elizabeth Warren, essentially nothing.
I totally agree. And we're— no, I definitely don't think that we're going to see a lot of legislative action between now and 2020. I don't think we would have if Republicans had held the House, because it wasn't like they had a legislative agenda either. But with gridlock, we're likely to see even less.
And
Catherine, how do you pronounce Rorschach?
So, yeah, I mean, my theory here, and it is not a novel theory, is that this is a Rorschach election. You see what you want to see. You see what your subconscious prods you to see. In this case, you know, people who want to focus on the fact that there was actually quite high turnout. 47% of voters cast a ballot in the 2018 midterms. That is high for midterms. It was, you know, it typically hovers down sub 40 or right around 40. So you could say, listen, actually, everybody was really energized on both sides. The caravans had people coming out, and also the Kavanaugh hearings had people coming out, and it just so happened to cancel each other out.
Well, and what's interesting is that Democrats thought that a higher turnout was definitely going to help them.
And Democrats thought a higher turnout was definitely going
to
help them, when in fact—
to not as much as they thought.
Right. In fact, like, their gains roughly correspond to their gain in the popular vote, which is another bugaboo that I think has hopefully been laid to rest here. I think, though, and again, you can, you know, it's fractal, right? Like, it's a fractal Rorschach blot. I'm so sorry, everyone. All the way down, you can look closer and closer and see evidence for whatever you want to see. So, you know, we were on election night, we were saying, hey, did everyone in a close race who voted to veto Kavanaugh, did they win? Or does everyone in a border state that is anti-immigrant, did they win? Right. I mean, everyone's sort of like looking for some kind of explanatory variable, including Peter, who wants to see that variable be healthcare. He might be right.
40% of people said it was their top issue in election poll, in exit polls. 70% of independents said it was their top issue.
Yes.
So for people who swing, it was the biggest issue. And overall, it was the biggest issue amongst the elect.
I guarantee someone right now at this exact moment is writing the hot take. This election was about gun control. 1 in 10 people said that guns were their top issue, but right now guns are in the news again. I'm so sorry, America, again. And so, like, this, you know, somehow someone will interpret election results that way. I lean strongly toward the Peter thesis that this election is evidence that as much as there's hysteria all around, people still are actually fundamentally behaving normally politically, that our system functions exactly as it has always functioned. And all of these jokes on Twitter about how Trump's election was the last election of our lifetime have, I think, proven deeply overwrought.
What happens next, though? Because this is, I mean, if politics, and I think it's true that, or Congress and the government is acting as it basically always has, it means it keeps spending more money because entitlement spending goes up and they don't do anything about the debt. Nobody is interested in talking about that. You get, you know, most of the Republicans are not saying we're going to repeal pre-existing conditions anyway, so that's kind of a push. Immigration policy, and certainly asylee policy and whatnot, flips every once in a while. There were times where Obama was really terrible on that and times when he was more open about it. Same thing with George Bush. So if the situation is normal, why are people flipping out about everything, including, you know, that the firing of Jeff Sessions is the beginning of the long knives, et cetera? Like, I mean, this is...
That is normal. You're right. That list of policies that you just described is normal. One thing that will happen because of the shift in control of the House is that even more things will be done via executive order than would have been done before, which means they will all be fully reversible. That there will be, you know, because it will be trickier to get things through Congress, even though it was already quite tricky, you know, stuff like immigration in particular will be subject to a total reversal when the other party takes the White House, as it inevitably will. But I think the other thing that happens, and this is what Peter was alluding to, is that Democrats are now going to really buckle down on their gigundo policy proposals. And I agree with you that the record of the candidates for 2020 right now is not impressive. But every single one of them has a huge, fancy, semi-socialist-ish plan. And that includes Elizabeth Warren saying we are going to regulate all corporations at the federal level. Elizabeth Warren also saying we're going to subsidize home buyers. Kamala Harris saying basically we're going to take the earned income tax credit and like give it a like inject meth into its eyeballs. You know, the Housing for All initiative.
Steroids, not meth.
And it's just really hyper.
So what happens if
it's going to get big?
Cory Booker's offering these baby bonds. Like, there are really big, juicy, substantive policy proposals, which are at least partially a response to this Republican failure to have policy ready when they got
power. But they're also a response to the 2016 election and the failure of running against Trump as Trump's a crazy person who is crazy and will destroy the country. What Democrats, and that's part of the reason why Democrats didn't push that argument quite as much in the midterm, is that that argument hasn't worked. So Democrats have returned to making more substantive, more policy-based arguments.
Well, let's put it this way. They have big ideas. They're not substantive. It's insane to pretend that we're going to do Medicare for all. If Medicare covering seniors is bankrupting the country,
I really disagree. I really think that I think Cory Booker's baby bonds proposal is a legit proposal that they are going to make enact.
Now, well, I think
it.
I don't know if they can.
Here's the question in the House.
You could have said the same thing about Obamacare.
Yeah, but in the House, first, if you have like at least 30 new people, most of them are neophytes, so they're going to take a while. If they're of the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez model, they're going to challenge Nancy Pelosi or try and pull her to the left, which is going to mean that they're not going to get shit done.
Which is going to be fun.
So, to go back to Matt's analogy, the House Democrats are going to look a lot like House Republicans, with the Freedom Caucus constantly challenging Boehner, with a whole lot of internal divisions, with big-ish ideas. I think repealing Obamacare, repealing a major entitlement was a big idea to some extent, even if they couldn't pull it off and didn't know what came next. But that's also going to be part of this, is that they're not going to be able to pull all of this off and they're not going to know what's next. But the trajectory here over the last, 50 years, over the life of Reason magazine, has been that Republicans basically bring things to a standstill until Democrats can find some way to advance the size and scope of government yet again.
Depressing. And the other thing that's going to happen is what happened yesterday.
I'm sorry, that's fundamentally wrong, Peter,
Washington.
In the 21st century, because it was George Bush and a Republican Congress that substantially expanded government, both early on with the Patriot Act, with No Child Left Behind, and Medicare expansion.
Okay, fair enough.
No, and so I think that, you know, these are the scripts. I wouldn't say they flipped, but we're in a different period now where the Democrats obviously talk about expanding government. The Republicans actually expand government. And we're now in a kind of Sitzkrieg where the Congress doesn't have to do anything, but they got a bunch of shit done, including signing farm bills and things like that. Defense spending always gets done and always goes up. And I think this is, you know, from a libertarian perspective, there are two things to keep in mind. One is the hyperactivity of kind of Trump derangement syndrome in the Twitter sphere and among media, where people really are like, Trump is starting to lock down his fascist government. And so he got rid of Jeff Sessions, et cetera. It's all coming. And he's going to fire Mueller and he's going to do this and he's going to do that. And that kind of stuff is just kind of nuts. But more troubling for me, because I think that is just, you know, kind of that's just a circus, is the fact that government is poised to slowly and inexorably grow, regardless of which party is in control, whether it's mixed control, whether it's split government or not. And that's the stuff that we really need to be hammering on. I mean, it's amazing to me that one of the few things Trump is good on, relatively speaking, which is foreign policy, like he hasn't started any new major wars. He's continued a bunch of really awful, immoral, and unqualified wars. But
he's pretty good. He hasn't started any new major wars.
But we know that's different
than
Hillary.
That's how you win the hearts of the Libertarian Editors podcast.
But that's better than Hillary would have been. But nobody in Congress, with the exception of a couple of libertarian-leaning
Republicans mostly, and maybe one or two Democrats, is even talking about foreign policy or is talking about defense spending. And, I think it's worth focusing on that kind of stalemate.
I will totally give you that Republicans have helped significantly to expand government. I've written this a million times. I don't know why I said that.
Thomas Massey, one of the only worthwhile Congress critters out there, tweeted after the election to his fellow colleagues, especially as they're all jockeying for position of, who gets to be the minority leader now. I think Jim Jordan is going after Kevin McCarthy, whatever. He's like, okay, now that you're all doing that, since our ideals now are entirely aspirational as opposed to actual, here being in the minority, what say we actually at least pretend to want the budget to be balanced and to slow the growth of government?
That really was the saddest tweet. I mean, it was partially sad because it was so true. It really is a very consistent pattern that Republicans readopt the rhetoric of small government whenever they're even somewhat out of power. And the fact that Massey was making a plea for that worthless thing to happen because he's not even sure that bit will happen was
I don't think it will happen. I honestly don't think that it will happen right now because as Mick Mulvaney presciently warned in his Wall Street Journal op-ed in March of 2015, when he said that it's immoral and wrong for Republicans to increase spending, period, without coming up with corresponding without just cutting spending, that if they don't do that, if they keep increasing spending, the next time that they're not in power or the next time they come to voters and say, hey, look, really, the Medicare trust fund is running out in 2026. You got to do something. People are going to say, you are not to be taken seriously. And you look around, and I didn't pay attention to every race or anything close to that. And I was focusing a lot on third party libertarian candidates, independent candidates, too. Debt and deficits, which are zooming past the $1 trillion mark right now, which used to be something that got people very excited in 2009, 10, and 11, wasn't an issue. The only person that I saw, only two people I saw making it a big issue was one, Gary Johnson, and he got 15.4% of the vote in his own home state against an absolute stiff of a Republican no one had ever heard of before named Mick Rich. Who was terrible in debates and got 31% of the vote. And Martin Heinrich sailed a re-election with 54. So Gary Johnson made it his signature issue, talked about it eloquently and profanely and got slaughtered. And the other person who talked about it a lot was Eric Brakey up in Maine, who was a Ron Paul guy. And he lost by God knows how many thousands of percentage points too. So it might just be dead, even as a fake rhetorical feint in that direction. And that's truly terrifying because we're on year 9 of an economic expansion. We're on year 9 of a bull market bull run in the stock market, although it's been ever since Trump announced his first tariff, it's been pretty flat and volatile, which seems like a contradiction in terms, but is not. And so when all that goes down, when it comes down, and it's going to, there's no way that it's not. Nothing ever lasts forever in economic terms. We're going to be sitting around in an era of increasing interest rates with $1 trillion deficits every year, $21.5 trillion and counting in overall debt. We're going to be so hosed. There's going to be nothing to spend money on, and there's not going to be any political blocks worth a good gall darn who have been consistently talking about this, except from the dwindling handful of people that we bring up on this podcast and elsewhere on Reason. So that's my cheery thought of the day. The other thing that I'll say, having already brought it up, that whenever there is a lot of political passion, a big high voter turnout type of race, which is allegedly, according to good government types, a desirable thing to have a lot of people voting. I tend to think that it's an indicator of a bad health, not that people can vote, but that people feel that things are so bad they need to vote. That's not always a good thing. But when that happens, the long noted you know, election day drop off in support for third party candidates and independent candidates gets all the more accelerated, because when people are voting out of a sense of fear and loathing towards their the other guy, you don't have time to fool around with these middling politicians who can't get us. So we saw that in very few cases did a third party or independent candidate get anywhere near like what they're polling. Actually, Gary Johnson came the closest out of many people. It was routine to have people's election day results be one half or even less of what they're polling there. And that suggests to me it's going to be a very difficult cycle to come out of, because I'm, to Nick's observation, I don't see us I don't see us lessening that sense of a kind of fear and worry and revulsion towards the other major party anytime soon. The end.
You've silenced us.
I ask, coming out of this, and now everybody's already turning to 2020, because it's kind of like, well, you know, we really can't get anything done in 2 years with divided government. So, you know, we got to wait to see what happens in 2020. Does either the Democratic or the Republican Party have a vision of the future that they're really laying out that is genuinely interesting to people? And the reason I bring that up is because Trump can't exist in a vacuum. And, you know, he goes after the press, he goes after Pocahontas, and, you know, it's all about, you know, I think we all know tons of people. We are probably, if you're like me, you're related to people who say, I don't really like Trump, but I like the fact that he's sticking it to liberals or progressives or Democrats. And that's his main selling point. On the other side, when the Democrats talk about all of the baby bond stuff or Medicare for all or giant entitlements that, you know, nobody actually, I don't think people are interested in that or believe that, or are like, oh yeah, you know, that would be great to have the government control more aspects of my basic commercial life, my, economic life, my cultural life, everything. They're not saying that. They just dislike Trump, and they like the fact that, you know, the Democrats are standing up to him. And it seems to me like this election, you know, it really nobody is coming up with a vision of the future that is at all appealing, much less sustainable. And, you know, until we break that logjam, it is just going to be this period of no decision that Morris Fiorina talks about, the political scientists like the late 19th and early 20th century, where control of the House, control of the Senate, control of the White House just flipped back and forth because the parties had essentially devolved into, you know, nothing other than, you know, a letter or a color.
My hunch, and it could just be towards my own devolution of my observation of politics, but that we presidentialize everything more and more. We look at things through the lens of who controls the White House, and which I don't think is very healthy in a lot of different ways. And we also, at that level and at other levels, treat politics on a consumer level about the way that it makes us feel. I think that Trump is expert at that. I mean, even in his press conference yesterday, which in many ways was super alarming. I mean, he spent a lot of time basically telling Republicans, look, you got to kiss my ring or else you're going to lose. We're going to Trumpify this party. Bye bye, flake. I mean, it was an incredible, and Maya Love, the way he treated her, is just awful. And some of those people who exited the scene, Carlos Cubello in Florida, are among of the better Republicans. So he's successfully Trumpifying the party, personalizing everything. And the firing of Jeff Sessions, it's itself is part of that process. He hated Jeff Sessions because Jeff Sessions recused himself from the Mueller investigation refused to run interference, and he wasn't subtle about this. He was direct about it, and all that is alarming. However, he's also in the same press conference very entertaining, like crazy, funny, and half or more of the times that he's going back and forth with the press, you kind of root for him, even though he's the one with the nuclear weapons. And Jim Acosta is just one with the the sign on his back saying "kick me because I deserve it." So he speaks to some kind of consumer need that we have, the way he makes us feel. And I think the other person on the Democratic side who does something similar was Beto O'Rourke. And watching his speech was more about that. He makes Democrats feel like that they are fighting the good fight, and that it's above politics, and that's the way we're going to win by decency. It's kind of a bit of a fable, and I think that he allows them in a similar way that Barack Obama did to we're doing this higher noble calling thing, unlike those terrible other people who we're not going to call terrible other people, even though we all know between you and me there are terrible other people.
Except for then Hillary accidentally did call them terrible other people. Election scandal.
Part of the reason why she doesn't excite people the way that Barack Obama and Beto O'Rourke did on that side. So I think the future of presidentialized politics is going to be people who tap into the way that these large blocs feel rather than a policy. Who even was talking about Beto O'Rourke's policies in this campaign? I don't think I heard anybody.
A lot
really
more
talk
about how he like maybe totally looked like JFK or something. I mean, yeah. I think the flip side of this, though, is the people camped out outside Tucker Carlson's house yesterday. Right. I mean, this is like, the Democratic Party or the American left self-image is that they're the good guys. A howling mob outside of a newsman's house.
So they were banging his door down.
Saying, threatening him and saying, that he is somehow the source of the lack of energy and the blue wave or whatever it is. I mean, the fact that they were out there the day after the election and not outside, say, Congress or the White House is telling. This feeling that what really matters is the flashy talk, and Tucker Carlson is the king of the flashy talk. I mean, that and I think, similarly with the scandal about Acosta's aggressive questioning. And are we calling it a karate chop now?
Is it a judo? It should be a karate chop, right? Because judo is mostly
karate
throws.
The karate chop appears to be partly doctored. In some of the footage that has been shared, it looks like they have sped up his hand motion to make it look more chop-like.
Is this the first deepfake?
Well, it's from Prison Planet,
it has been alleged, and I cannot confirm this myself, that Sarah Huckabee Sanders
is your shit. It's like this
shared non-story footage.
Whereas I do think like the Tucker Carlson story is deeply disturbing, and Catherine, this goes
but
back.
But it's the same. It's the same story.
When is the last time you remember a newsman being like, first up, being accosted on the street? And that's Dan Rather. And that was by somebody that we don't know, the Kenneth, what is the frequency? Bit from the 90s or the 80s even, but like to have an actual mob banging on the door of a newsman, that's kind of new. And I think it is deeply disturbing. And this is where we go to the circus atmosphere, which obviously Trump revels in. The more this happens, the more his people are going to be, the real problem is Jim Acosta, flipping somebody on their back, et cetera. And, how this is totally unlike Corey Lewandowski, knocking a reporter over, et cetera. But I don't even know how you, do you engage this stuff or do you ignore it? Because it's all just horse crap.
It's not with a newsman, but we've seen folks drive prominent Republican figures out of restaurants on a number of occasions.
But there's, wouldn't you agree that there's a distinction between politicians being hectored in their home, in their jurisdictions even?
I would agree with this, but given that so many on the left, especially the sort of activist left, view Fox News as basically state-run television, they don't make that difference. I think that's a problem, but they don't make that distinction.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's a sense in which people see Tucker Carlson as an adjunct member of the administration, and you can hardly blame them when Sean Hannity is standing up on the stump for Trump. I mean, those lines do feel blurry. And, for us, for libertarians, the public-private distinction is so central, so important, and is always a bright line. And for much of the rest of the world, that's not the case. That's the same is true with, you know, I don't want Google reading my email, and I don't want the NSA reading my email. That feels like the same thing to a lot of people. So, I think on our perennial question, which I'm sure we will talk about many, many more times in this podcast in the next couple of years, of, you know, how do we talk about things that really matter, and what even are the things that really matter? I'm not entirely unsympathetic to the idea that under Donald Trump, rhetoric and showmanship is they are the things that really matter, because every now and then they're going to spike and produce the genuinely unusual policy outcomes. And here I'm thinking mostly about immigration.
LOL, nothing matters.
Let's close here because we've been a little bit negative, I think.
I've been positive. It's really the status quo. I mean, this is a status quo election, which Peter was kind of saying at the beginning as well. Not a status quo, but a conventional midterm election.
Listeners, vote. Go on Twitter, make one of those little poll thingies. Has Nick Gillespie been positive or negative in this podcast?
Ooh.
Okay, I want that poll up there.
And let's take it to the crowd.
A third option involving Boog Powell. I don't know how. Just put Boog Powell's name in there, just to kind of keep things open. But
Peter and I are making the "We Are Younger Than You, Who the Hell is Boog Powell?"
Oh, come
face
on.
In each other
who
right now.
Who the hell is Boog Powell?
Google is going to be a revelation on that one, Catherine.
Boog.
How do you spell
Boog?
B-O-O-G. Exactly like it sounds. And the other thing that is funny about, and this is really that Boog Powell was considered a fat load in his day, whereas now Matt, I think he's aspirational for both of us in terms of
the autocomplete on Boog Powell is pretty promising, since the autocompletes are stats, wife, and barbecue.
Yep, that covers it. Let's close on what each of you took as a single optimistic or positive thing that happened at the polling booth on Tuesday. I will start with Peter.
The criminal justice reforms passed in Florida. And it's weird. I mean, maybe it's not weird, actually. Given how the major Florida races were run, you would sort of expect that voters in that state might be less willing to entertain what until very recently were assumed to be quite liberal, exclusively Democratic left criminal justice reforms, including one basically is going to reenfranchise 1.4 million felons who lost their voting rights. And that was basically assumed to be a sort of a Democratic ploy to bring Democratic voters into the system. I'm serious.
No,
like,
I know.
That was the political understanding of it.
Republicans don't
get
sent
to
jail.
But this is a good thing. And it shows, I think, that there is a growing bipartisan consensus for criminal justice reform, Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump notwithstanding.
Nick, besides all of your brimming optimism, other?
Well, here, very quickly, two things. One is that the marijuana initiatives passed, and to follow up on Peter's basic, or the larger point, which is that initiatives get outside of the both political parties are losing, they're losing recognition or deep feelings with voters. People are going outside to the initiative process, and they're passing stuff that is actually genuinely popular among the masses of people, the majority of people. So I think that's good. The other thing which I want to say, and it's not a direct, it's an indirect result of the elections happening, but it's a good thing that Jeff Sessions is kicked out. Jeff Sessions, and one of the things, and this is where I'm, you know, people with Trump derangement syndrome, all they've been saying all along is that Jeff Sessions is an absolute piece of junk and he's the worst attorney general in all time, et cetera. And he's got to go. And then when Trump gets rid of him, they're like, oh, wait, what's going on? What's going on? It's actually Jeff Sessions is a horrible, horrible attorney general. He was a bad senator. And hopefully he won't return as a senator when he's 800 years old in the next election cycle. But so those are two good things.
Can I argue with you just a little bit? I'm going to argue with you just a little bit, which is Jeff Sessions was a terrible senator and a terrible attorney general on all of our issues in the way he ran the Justice Department. But he wasn't fired for being terrible on those
issues. It doesn't matter.
He was fired because Donald Trump thought that he wasn't loyal and wouldn't protect
him. That's the job of the attorney general is the president's lawyer. They are hired in order to be pit bulls for the president. Eric Holder was that. Eric Holder did not count. You know, he wasn't standing
but
up.
But they
for
shouldn't be.
No, but that's what they
it
always
is, but
are.
They shouldn't
they
be.
Always are. I don't
but
see that as
be.
A problem. Anybody. It's not that anybody will be better than Jeff Sessions, but it gives us the opportunity to have somebody who's better than Jeff Sessions. And we might end up with somebody who's worse. And if Trump tries to put the kibosh on the Mueller investigation, which by all accounts is going to have a report soon, that will be its own scandal that will precipitate, you know, possibly, a deeply serious conversation. But I think, you know, Sessions, it was nice knowing you. Don't let the door hit you on the way out.
I think it's quite possible that the replacement will be just as bad and maybe even worse, and especially since Chris Kobach is now being floated as the possible successor, and he in particular on immigration would just be terrible.
And going back at least to Janet Reno, we have had a string of remarkably bad attorneys general who are just awful on policy issues. So I agree that things can always get worse.
Chris Kobach is my pick for a happy result. He lost his bid to win the governorship of Kansas. He's the person single most associated with voter fraud. Fantasia was the headed up the president's debacle of I think they called it the Voter Integrity Commission, which was horribly handled in every way. Every time Chris Kobach goes to court, he represents himself, loses, and then gets punished by the judge for being a bad lawyer. He is a cretin. He's a bad person. And in the perennial vote against douchebags wars that we all fight here, and we lost too many of them. Menendez still in office. Duncan Hunter still in office. At least Kobach.
Matt, wasn't this supposed to be the positive segment?
Yeah, seriously, bro. I have like a light answer prepared and you're really harshing my buzz.
Go, Catherine. Go. Get us out of this.
The Bigfoot erotica aficionado won.
That's true.
And the dead pimp.
Yeah, well, yeah. Let me finish my thing. And the dead pimp and Clint Bolick. Those are my three bright spots. Clint Bolick, the libertarian Arizona justice who won his reelection bid by, I think he got like 71% of the vote. That's good. People in Arizona like Republicans who are basically libertarians. And who doesn't like a race in which a dead pimp and a dude mostly famous for a picture of Bigfoot's penis are victorious? That's where we are right now.
It really is the libertarian moment.
Truly, there was actually a moment on Reason's site on election night where the write-up, which the full headline is, Bigfoot erotica aficionado Denver Riggleman beat Olivia Wilde's mom in Virginia congressional race. That was our top hit for a minute on election night, and I felt proud to work at Reason.
Every word of that headline is accurate.
It's a journey,
glorious.
That headline. So there's a little bit of good news. Other good news, which is a silver lining on a dark cloud. I have pledged on Twitter to go and reenact Duncan Hunter's bachelor party night in Adams Morgan. So if anyone wants to come with me, we're getting 30 shots of tequila and one steak at El Tamarindo this weekend.
Each, right?
No, it's a total. That's how it is. So you gotta decide whether
that's
you're the guy who gets the
steak
or the guy who gets the tequila.
Did he drink all 30 shots or do we know?
No, he ordered them for a bachelor party on his campaign.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
See, America is still great. Thank you all for listening to this unusual, irregular Reason Editors Roundtable podcast. And stay tuned and you'll hear us talk about totally different things on Monday. Goodbye.